Good afternoon, Golden Hawks. Thanks for tuning in to Radio Laurier. My name is Megan, and you are listening to The Downbeat, the show where I get into the nitty-gritty, the deep cuts, and the hot topics of rock and roll throughout the decades. Now, before we dive into this week's topic, I would just like to provide a trigger warning, as this episode deals with topics that may be upsetting to some listeners. Now, enough of the formalities, let's get into it. This week, being my first episode and all, I decided to dive into a topic that I myself have been reading up on for a while, and that is the death of grunge rock godfather, Kurt Cobain. As someone born in the 2000s but raised on 90s alternative rock, the life and death of Kurt Cobain feels so personal yet so alien at the same time. Whereas many fans who were present in the 90s watched certain events unfold, like the rise of the grunge movement, Nirvana's switch from sub-pop to the major, and yes, Kurt's death, I've had to piece together the story for myself. Regardless, I feel as though I have done enough research, read enough articles, and yes, reposted enough band photos on Pinterest to peg myself as an authentic fan. The problem is, as true punk rockers often are, most Nirvana fans are convinced that they are far more authentic and knowledgeable than any other rock simpleton that they come across. I mean, why shouldn't they? So many people were touched by his music, message, and overall punk rock attitude that they felt like they knew him. Most people who were grunge fans during the genre's heyday, from 91 onward, could probably tell you where they were when they heard the news. Kurt Cobain took his own life. Hell, even I myself felt as though I'd mourned a loss when I found out, give or take, 20 years after the fact. He had a quality about him that makes every listener feel as though they can relate to him on the deepest of levels. His lyrics were unlike anything I'd ever heard before. He was genuine. He was a rock star for the downtrodden. It is this phenomenon, this exalted image of Kurt and what he represented, that I believe has cultivated two very different groups of Nirvana fans, those who truly understood what he represented, and those who refused to accept just that. But more on that later. For now, let's get into the details of the events leading up to April 8th, 1994, when the body of Kurt Cobain was found in the greenhouse of his Seattle home. For those of you who are unaware, Kurt had a very long struggle with health problems in the last few years of his life, particularly with his stomach. The problem was only exacerbated by his career, as Kurt's trademark growling sound when he sings comes from the way that he sings from his stomach. The pain was so unbearable it often left him incapacitated, unable to play shows. Describing the pain, Kurt said, "I was in pain. I was in pain for so long that I didn't care if I was in a band. I didn't care if I was alive. It was building up for so many years that I was suicidal, you know? I just didn't want to live." After seeing specialist after specialist, no correct diagnosis could be made. In an interview with MTV in 1993, Kurt said he had been seeing doctors and taking their prescriptions for 6 years, but nothing stuck. That is, until he came across the drug that he was on at the time of the interview. It was a godsend. Thanks to this drug, he hadn't had stomach issues since. Now, all right, to the uninformed listener, this seems great. A magic cure finally ended 6 years of pain, but those of us who know the rest of the story are aware what this magic drug was, why it worked so fast, and how it sent Kurt down a spiral from which he never returned. The drug was heroin. Cobain had been using Clearly before the 1993 interview, as in early 1992, he had a brief stint in a rehabilitation facility. His prolonged use of the drug can likely be explained by not only the addictive element of it, but, as aforementioned, that it was the only cure to the stomach pain he had been dealing with for years. The pain, as with many gastrointestinal disorders, was brought on by stress. According to Cobain, the sudden success of his band, launching into superstardom with 1991's Nevermind, worsened the pain. Each show, each recording session, and tour stint left him in greater need of a fix. By 1994, however, it became clear that even smack couldn't cure Kurt's pain, both physical and mental. On March 4th, he was found by his wife, Courtney Love, on the floor of a hotel bathroom, overdosed on champagne and Rohypnol, which, for those of you who don't know, is roofies, basically. After being brought to the hospital and being comatose for 20 hours, Kurt awoke. On March 18th, he locked himself in a room again with his gun collection, this time threatening to kill himself. And by March 25th of the same year, Kurt's family and friends held an intervention at their home in Seattle, and Kurt agreed to check himself into a 12-day rehab program in an LA facility. Now, let's take a pause for a second. I don't know about you, but I would say at this point in the story, it is quite evident that Kurt Cobain was in fact suicidal. Had it not been for his 2-year-old daughter, Frances Bean Cobain, he might have died even sooner. It is at this point in the timeline of Kurt's death that many conspiracy theorists begin to point out odd inconsistencies in the events leading up to April 8th. Remember when I mentioned two types of Nirvana fans? This is where I believe those two groups diverge. March 30th, 1994. Kurt buys another gun. The same day he checked into rehab, Kurt made a pit stop in Seattle. As I mentioned before, in a previous encounter with the police, Kurt was found locked in a room with his gun collection. As a result of this incident, his weapons were confiscated and a felony charge was placed, preventing him from purchasing a firearm of his own. This is why, on March 30th, it was not Kurt Cobain's name registered on the 20-gauge shotgun purchased in Seattle, but rather that of his best friend and fellow musician, Dylan Carlson. It was this gun that was found at the scene on April 8th when the body was discovered. The question is, why would Kurt's best friend willingly buy him a suicide weapon? Well, I think that it is important to point out that Carlson himself has a history of drug abuse. Two strung-out junkies buying a gun makes a whole lot more sense than two level-headed buddies perusing for a new 20-gauge. Neither Kurt nor Dylan were in a particularly healthy mental space at the time. Now, I think given the circumstances, the situation can easily be summed up by some drug-induced paranoia. However, many people refuse to use this rationale, and instead believe that Kurt was not in fact buying the gun to shoot himself, but rather to protect himself. At this point, you may be asking, if the gun really was purchased for self-defense, why would Kurt be in fear of his life? Who was he so afraid of? What person would be so evil and cunning as to plot and get away with the murder of, at the time, the biggest rock star in the world? And, most importantly, who has anything to gain from that? Well, some rumors about a potential divorce and, in my opinion, some blatant misogyny leads many fans to answer with their favorite problematic pariah, Miss Courtney Love. Let's flash back to the months leading up to Kurt's death. There was a lot of talk about potential divorce between the couple. The problem preventing this divorce from going through was a prenuptial agreement. The prenup would leave Courtney basically penniless in regards to the Nirvana fortune. To make matters worse, it was rumored that Kurt contacted his own lawyer to have his wife removed from his will altogether. In short, many people believed that Courtney had Kurt killed to remain in his will. Now, I personally believe that the circumstances surrounding these accusations are completely unreasonable, but I will leave that discussion for later on in the episode. For now, let's get back to Kurt. April 1st, a week before he was found dead, Kurt escaped the LA rehab clinic. He called Courtney, who was at the time promoting her album Live Through This with her own band Hole. He left her a message with a phone number that she could reach him at. After this, he flew back to Seattle from LA. In the meantime, Kurt's friends and family became concerned over his whereabouts. Courtney even allegedly planted a story about her overdosing in the Seattle newspaper to try to get his attention, yet no luck. What admittedly confuses me, and apparently a lot of theorists about this situation, is that at the time, Courtney supposedly had a phone number to reach Kurt at. So why is it that she used all of these scheming tactics to try and seek him out? This wrinkle in the story is often used by theorists to draw another link from Courtney back to the gun purchase made in Seattle. They say that she was actively trying to find Kurt with malicious intent. Kurt knew this and feared for his life, spurring him to buy a gun, go MIA, and hide away in the greenhouse, where he was eventually found and, well, murdered. I think that she simply called the number, didn't like what she heard, or didn't get an answer at all, and thus went on a spree trying to find her missing husband. To me, this is understandable, but alas, I will let you draw that conclusion for yourself. Nonetheless, Courtney was searching for Kurt. She was so eager to find her husband, Courtney hired a private detective by the name of Tom Grant, a decision that I'm willing to bet she now regrets. On the 4th, it was official. A missing persons report was filed. In the following days, Tom Grant and Dylan Carlson, remember the one who bought the gun, went to Kurt and Courtney's house in Seattle to search for him. They had no such luck, except they never looked in the greenhouse. There's yet another level of suspicion at this point in the story because, let's keep in mind, Dylan Carlson was Kurt's best friend. He had been to their house on several occasions and knew where everything was. And here's what I think happened. Dylan had some sort of idea about Kurt's intentions. Was it that he knew he was going to kill himself? I'm not sure. But I do think that when a big sleuthy detective started sniffing around the house, Carlson covered for Kurt. The conclusion that I draw from the situation, and again, you don't have to agree with me, this is just my opinion, Kurt did not want to be found, and Dylan respected that. Because, had they went into the greenhouse, in a room upstairs overlooking the property, they would have found the same thing as electrician Gary Smith did on April 8, 1994. The body of a man with a shotgun on his chest and a suicide note beside him. He was unrecognizable, but the fingerprints on the autopsy identified the body of Kurt Cobain. It is better to burn out than to fade away. This Neil Young lyric was the final word of remembrance Kurt left for his fans in his suicide note. I don't think that anything could sum up the career and death of Kurt Cobain better than that line. As I so ambiguously mentioned earlier, I believe that there are two types of Nirvana fans. Those who truly understood what he represented and those who refused to accept just that. As tragic as his death was, as hard as it hit the music community, this was the way Kurt wanted his life, at least in the course that it was taking, to unfold. He never wanted the mainstream fame. He never wanted the glory. He never wanted to be idolized. He never wanted the money. He wanted to live an authentic life, which is the exact opposite of what fame brought him. What frustrates me the most about the story of Kurt's death is those who refuse to see it as a closed case, the people who refuse to accept it. Those who rifle through old police evidence and buy into the Tom Grant BS theories about how he was murdered and it's Courtney's fault. This is the exact opposite of what I think Kurt would have wanted. I think that these excerpts from a note he wrote for the release of 1992's compilation album Incesticide best explains what I mean. My wife challenges injustice, and the reason her character has been so severely attacked is because she chooses not to function the way the white corporate man insists. His values for women involve her being submissive, quiet, and non-challenging. When she doesn't follow his rules, the threatened man gets scared. A big thank you to those of you who have the audacity to claim that I'm so naive and stupid that I would allow myself to be taken advantage of and manipulated. It is that last line, the disgust at the thought of being viewed as some sort of puppet in Courtney's clutches, is what makes me frustrated by the unnecessary ambiguity surrounding Kurt's death. In my opinion, being a fan of someone requires a certain level of respect. To completely disregard this message by suggesting Courtney was able to manipulate, murder, and swindle Kurt out of his riches is the exact opposite of respecting his memory. In his suicide note, he directly expressed his love and admiration for his wife and daughter. He wanted them to go on to have happy lives without him. Yet fans continue to hate and throw blame at Courtney. Kurt was always outspoken about his feminist ideals. To this day, fans still praise him for his progressive opinions and outspokenness surrounding such subjects. So, how can one claim to be a fan of Kurt while pointing the blame at the one woman he loved simply because she is unapologetically herself? Now, I know, Courtney has had her own deal of controversies, and I can confidently say that in the past she was far from a good person, but regardless of if you like her or not, directly blaming her for the death of Kurt is outright ridiculous and misogynistic. Closed-minded views surrounding female hysteria do not validate murder accusations. And, to be quite honest, given her history of erratic behavior and personal drug use, I don't think Courtney could have pulled off something like that, even if she had wanted to. To even further my point, particularly surrounding Kurt's, to put it not so lightly, urge to die, here's another excerpt from the same letter. I don't feel the least bit guilty for commercially exploiting a completely exhausted rock youth culture, because at this point in rock history, punk rock, while still sacred to some, is, to me, dead and gone. We just wanted to pay tribute to something that helped us to feel as though we had crawled out of the dung heap of conformity. I'll be the first to admit that we're the 90s version of Cheap Trick or The Knack, but the last to admit that it hasn't been rewarding. Even in 1992, when this note was released, Kurt felt as though his trajectory as an authentic performer had run its course. He did not feel pleasure in his work as he thought he should. He felt guilty about the overproduction of Nevermind, a cardinal sin of the Seattle grunge scene, and so released a compilation of heavier tracks to compensate for it, which was Incesticide. He was in consistent pain and was an addict far from recovery. By April of 1994, he had made his message clear. It was better to burn out than to fade away. I understand where people are coming from when they refuse to accept Kurt's death as it was. He meant so much to people, particularly those who have been outcast from the jump. He is so integrated into pop culture now, you can't walk into an Urban Outfitters or a Hot Topic without finding a t-shirt with his face on it. Nirvana's music continues to impact people today. I myself, a 19-year-old business student with an alt-rocker dad, can attest to that. But no measure of evidence, or lack thereof, will convince me that continuing to analyze Kurt's death will bring any justice or peace. He is gone, and we cannot change that. It is how we memorialize him, as the kind, liberal, considerate person that he was, that matters the most. So, now that Kurt is gone, where does that leave everyone else? As the world grieved over Kurt's death, so did his band members, friends, and family. In the years following, there were some legal battles surrounding music rights. The remaining band members, Dave Grohl, now of Foo Fighters fame, you might have heard of him, and bassist Chris Novoselic, were hit with a lawsuit by Love for taking ownership over music that she claimed to be purely Kurt's work. That is neither here nor there, but the bottom line is that the three of them have not exactly had a solid relationship since Kurt's passing. I think this is also a reason as to why people like to point fingers at Courtney for the death of Kurt. But alas, you can't charge people for murder just because you don't like them. Speaking of the remaining members, they each took very different paths following Kurt's death. Grohl, as I just mentioned, started the band The Foo Fighters, which have since become a massive stadium success. Chris, on the other hand, made a complete 180 by starting a career in politics. The two have the occasional public encounter, but the most notable moment came in 2014, when the band was inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. Their performance included a rendition of Smells Like Teen Spirit with Joan Jett on vocals, and a performance of Lithium assisted by the artist known as St. Vincent. Courtney was also there for the acceptance of the award, but her presence seemed far from welcome by the audience and admittedly Novoselic alike. Booing from the audience arose as soon as she stepped up to the microphone, and I believe you can find that video on YouTube if you are interested. Speaking of Courtney, since Kurt's death, Love continued to put out music with her band Hole, although members notably changed, as did the quality of the music, until their last release in 2010. I must admit, I am personally a huge fan of Hole. I don't know everything about Courtney as a person, and there is undoubtedly a lot I would rather not know. However, she has seemed to clean up her act. She got clean and has taken up Buddhism, although she is known to stir up some controversy on Instagram from time to time, calling out many industry bigwigs who she deems worthy of a takedown. And what about Tom Grant? Oh, you have no idea who I'm talking about because I've only mentioned this guy twice so far in the episode? Fair enough. Tom Grant was the investigator that was hired by Courtney to find Kurt when he went missing in April of 1994. This turned out to be a mistake for Love, however, as he has since made a career out of accusing her of murder. He runs a website that looks straight out of 2001 called CobainCase.com. He's also written two books titled The Mysterious Death of Kurt Cobain and The Cobain Case Study Manual. In addition to these works, he has also got into film, apparently, with Soaked in Bleach, released in 2015. That one's actually strictly about him being on the case. Did I mention he investigated Kurt's death? Anyways. There's one last person that I think deserves a spotlight in the wake of all of this, and that's Frances Bean Cobain. Since her father's passing, Frances's relationship with her mother has been rocky. She's managed to stay out of the spotlight, but it appears that since Courtney's sudden spiritual awakening and a messy divorce on Frances's end, the two have reconciled. Frances also owns the publicity rights to her dad's name and image, so go Frances. And as for the fans, well, we get to uphold Kurt's legacy by doing what we've always done. Yeah. Listen to the music. Oh no, not me. We never lost control. Now, I think it's only fitting that in this episode we get into a bit of a discussion about Nirvana's actual music. I mean, we got time, so why not? I'll be getting into the band's discography, pointing out some of my favorite tracks, some fun facts, and just providing my general thoughts on each album. If you're somewhat new to Nirvana's music or only listen to the hits, I hope you'll find this informative. And if you're a major fan, I guess I'm interested to hear what you have to think about my opinions. But before I get into my opinions and top picks, I would like to state very clearly that I am by no means a musician. I have and will likely always be an intense music fan. I love reading about music and its history. I love going to see live music and collecting vinyl. However, I have no musical background. I don't know theory, nor do I play any instruments. As such, these are simply my opinions from a listening perspective. That being said, let's get into it. Despite their catastrophic impact on the mainstream, Nirvana only put out 3 full-length albums. Yes, you heard me right, only 3. These are, in chronological order, Bleach, Nevermind, and In Utero. However, the new Nirvana fan need not fret, as the band has many live releases and anniversary B-sides to delve into if you so choose. My personal favorite live album, as I'm sure is the same for the average Nirvana fan, is their Live at MTV Unplugged in New York album from 1994. Aside from this, there is also Incesticide, a 1992 compilation release with a harsher true grunge sound, and a single called You Know You're Right, which was released after Kurt's death and the legal battle between the band and Courtney that preceded it. Now, before I get ahead of myself, I would like to establish a little bit of cultural context for the time that this music was being put out. For those of you who are unfamiliar with the Seattle grunge scene, here is a very, very brief history. In the late 80s and early 90s, Seattle was a hub for alternative art forms, including what at the time was dubbed alternative music. This underground scene managed to produce a unique sound called the Seattle Sound, also known as grunge. The bands that partook in the Seattle scene were firm in their anti-capitalist beliefs and were very much against the corporate mainstream music industry. This developed an alternative subculture within the city that was very much separate from the rest of the music being put out in the rest of the states and in Canada. This transgressive nature of the scene is also apparent in the stylistic elements of the music. Although grunge is a fusion of punk rock and heavy metal, it lacks the structure and fast pace typical of your average, say, Ramones or Black Sabbath song. However, the amateurism common in punk rock and metal is extremely present in that of grunge. As I said before, the grunge scene stayed in Seattle for the majority of the late 80s and early 90s, and those who made it big there often recorded it at the indie label Sub Pop Records. Popular bands including Pearl Jam, Soundgarden, Alice in Chains, and yes, Nirvana were among them. It was not until the release of Nirvana's album Nevermind in 1991 that the rest of the world got to taste the Seattle sound, changing the culture forever. Suddenly, people were moshing at weddings and dancing to Smells Like Teen Spirit at a club on a Friday. This was extremely controversial in the scene, as the band was viewed as a sellout. But more on that later. Eventually, many of the bands that were big in Seattle also signed to the major labels, and grunge was officially music of the mainstream. So, there you go. That's Meg's crash course on the history of grunge. But as I said, Nirvana put out 3 albums throughout their career, the second of which was Nevermind. So, what music were they making before they hit the world stage, while they were delved into the Seattle grunge scene? Let's talk about Bleach. Bleach. Released by Sub Pop Records in 1989, Bleach is understandably harsher sounding than its successors. Cobain himself even said that working with Sub Pop made him feel pressured into creating music that catered more towards the typical Seattle sound. As a result, the thrashing tracks sound much harsher and bleaker in comparison to those of Nevermind and even In Utero. The record label described it as sludge metal, another subgenre of the Washington scene, which has roots in doom metal and hardcore punk. In short, Bleach is a true Seattle grunge record. Admittedly, their least popular album among mainstream audiences, few songs from the track list are super well-known. That is, in comparison to, say, the likes of Smells Like Teen Spirit or Heart-Shaped Box. But one song from Bleach that I think is most recognizable among rock fans, and understandably so, is About a Girl. Interestingly enough, it is admittedly the least sludge metal song on the album, which is likely why it was the most popular in the mainstream. Popular enough that it was released again on the same compilation album as the unreleased You Know You're Right in 2002. So, if you're curating your Nirvana Essentials playlist anytime soon, give this one an add. As for my own opinion, it truly is one of my favorites from the album. I can get into some of the heavier tracks, but something about a Girl just goes down a bit easier for individual listening. If About a Girl comes up on shuffle, I'm much more likely to keep it on than, say, Negative Creep. Both are excellent songs, but the former is a bit more digestible, I guess, for easy listening. However, I think that this is the very reason so many listeners don't give Bleach much of a chance in comparison to Nevermind and In Utero. The tragedy is the record has so many good songs if you're willing to try and enjoy them. Some of the band's most headbangable material comes from Bleach, and I think that this is what makes it so great. I put on my copy of Bleach for the same reason one might put on Metallica. It gets the aggression out. So, let's talk about my favorites. Scoff, number 8 on the track list, always gets a replay when I have Bleach on. The thundering beat particularly highlights the talents of original Nirvana drummer Chad Channing, and the repetitive guitar is a bit of a precursor to the style of Nevermind. Think Smells Like Teen Spirit, but with a bit more grit and just general screaming. Negative Creep seems to be one of the more popular tracks among Nirvana fans, and I understand why. It is an excellent representation of the moody and angsty themes common in Seattle grunge music. If you have yet to listen to it, I highly suggest it if you want a feel of what the late 80s Nirvana was all about. Other favorites of mine include Mr. Mustache and Love Buzz. Overall, I enjoy the record, but admittedly would say it's my least favorite of the three studio releases they put out. I find it, quite ironically, to be their least authentic release. Although the band got a lot of flack for their popular releases later on in their career, at least that was music that they, at the time at least, thought they wanted to be making. Don't get me wrong, the album is fantastic, but I think it is a better representation of the Seattle sound than of the Nirvana sound itself. Now, just for fun, let's rank the tracks, shall we? In my humble opinion, these are the songs of Bleach ranked. Coming in at number 13 is Downer. Number 12 is Sifting. Number 11, Paper Cuts. Number 10, Big Cheese. Number 9, Floyd the Barber. Number 8, Swamp Meat. 7 is School. 6 is Mr. Mustache. 5 is Love Buzz. 4 is About a Girl. 3 is Blue. 2 is Negative Creep, and coming in at number 1, we have Scoff. Now again, these are just my rankings. If your opinion differs from it, that's totally okay, but that's just my personal opinion. In terms of absolute must-listens for this album, I would definitely say Love Buzz is the one. That's the ultimate for me. And a song you should listen to if you don't already know it is About a Girl. Educate yourself on your Nirvana knowledge. Now, let's tackle the big one. The album that changed the course of pop music forever. The record that catapulted grunge into the mainstream. 1991's Nevermind. After switching to the major label, DGC Records, Nirvana was met with a lot of backlash, particularly from underground-minded audiences. Grunge fans criticized the band for selling out to the major label and ditching their harsher punk rock sound that is undoubtedly present on Bleach. Mainstream audiences, however, did not seem to have much of a problem with the record. The album itself spent 335 weeks total on the Billboard Top 200 list, and 5 of the 12 songs on the album charted. Its pop-centric sound is most notable on the band's biggest hit, Smells Like Teen Spirit. The single itself charted all around the world and reached number 6 on Billboard's Hot 100. Interestingly enough, the iconic riff from the song is suspiciously similar to that of one of classic rock fame, Boston's More Than a Feeling, from their self-titled album released in 1975. The band even poked fun at this one night at a show as they started playing their song while singing the Boston lyrics over top. The two are suspiciously similar, but from my understanding, there was no legal repercussions for the similarity. And if you're interested, I'm sure that you can find the clip somewhere on YouTube. Another interesting fact about the album is that the opening drums in the track In Bloom were not in fact created by then-drummer Dave Grohl. He admitted at the band's Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee speech that it was actually written by original drummer Chad Channing. Maybe that interests you, maybe you couldn't care less, but I think it's one of the best parts of the song, and thus should give credit where credit is due. But, fun facts aside, the cleaner and, yes, poppier sound of Nevermind was a smash success, bringing us some of the band's most notable work, including Come As You Are, Lithium, In Bloom, and Polly, all of which are now alternative rock radio staples. Let's discuss, shall we? Come As You Are is, to me, the ultimate Nirvana staple. Yes. Smells Like Teen Spirit was their biggest hit, but there is nothing more iconic than that opening riff. I mean, come on. Also, random question, has anyone heard of a group called Killing Joke? Well, neither had I until I came across one of their songs on my Spotify suggested. The thing is, I didn't even know that the song I was listening to was one I'd never heard before. The opening riff to 80s by Killing Joke is extremely similar to that of Come As You Are. If you haven't already, I suggest having a listen. Although a bit more sped up and with less reverb, it's still a fun tune to get into. Lithium is another Nirvana classic from the album that is a fan favorite. What I find so likable about the song is the balance between calm and madness that the group undoubtedly mastered with the record. By combining the calm, sing-speaking verses with the booming, almost true grunge-sounding choruses, Cobain and the band managed to develop a much more palatable version of grunge for mainstream audiences. In Lithium, you get that thrashing rock of, say, Negative Creep from Bleach, but in a much more digestible package. The build-up towards the chorus makes the explosive guitar and vocals all the more thrilling. Alright, now let's talk deep cuts, if those really exist on a monster album like this one. The first half of the album is very similar in that pop with a punch kind of way. I think that it's the later tracks, such as Drain You, On a Plane, and Something in the Way, that help to balance out the somewhat shiny sound of some of the A-side tracks. Not to say that they're particularly aggressive like the songs of Bleach, but they drop the pop formula and stick more towards the messy structure of traditional Seattle grunge. Let's take Drain You, for example. This is one of my favorites on the entire record because of its mishmash style. The introductory bare vocal is great, and the first crashing in of the rest of the band is timed, to me at least, perfectly. It is clearly one of the most artistically liberal songs on the album. I mean, there's a break in the middle of it filled with feedback, and to me what sounds like a rubber duck, I'm not entirely sure. What I'm trying to say is that if you've been listening strictly to the hits and are looking to expand your horizons a little bit, this is definitely a must listen. And if you enjoy it, try out Lounge Act next. I think that's kind of a similar vibe with that one. Lastly, let's talk about the second last track on the album, Something in the Way. I find it to be an interesting prelude of sorts to what audiences can expect from Nirvana's final album, In Utero. The moody, mellow acoustic quality foreshadows the likes of songs such as Penny Royalty and All Apologies, which I will touch on in a minute. I think that is why the album is so beloved and it remains to be their best-selling record. It has the raunchy, like thrashing punk rock appeal of Bleach, with songs like Breed and In Bloom and Drain You, but the slower, melancholy appeal of In Utero, as I just mentioned. What I'm trying to say is that Nevermind is a cult album, with a little bit of something for everyone. And of course, I did it for Bleach, I've gotta do it for Nevermind. This is my ranking of the tracks, and again, if you don't agree with me, I am so sorry. This is just my opinion. At number 13, we have Endless Nameless. Number 12, Stay Away. 11, Territorial Pissings. 10, Lounge Act. 9, On a Plane. 8, Polly. Number 7, Smells Like Teen Spirit. Number 6 is Breed. 5, Something in the Way. Coming in at number 4 is Lithium. Number 3, In Bloom. In second place, we have Drain You, and of course, my number one has to be Come As You Are. Now again, this is an impeccable album, and I love every single one of these songs, so last place doesn't really mean all that much, but if you wanted my opinion, that's what it is. In terms of must-listens for this album, it's all of them. I'm sorry. If you want to be an educated Nirvana fan, you gotta do the homework. You gotta have a listen to every single one. And a song that you should absolutely know if you don't already is Drain You, simply because I'm selfish and it's one of my favorites. Now, for my personal favorite, the 1993 release and final Nirvana album, In Utero. This is one of those albums that I could listen to from start to end every single day and never get sick of it. The opening song, Serve the Servants, is likely my favorite Nirvana song of all time. I think that although he's denied any connection, it perfectly summed up the situation that Kurt was in at the time of the album's release. Not in the sense that he was trapped in a marriage he so desperately wanted out of. The lyrics mention divorce, and of course, people are going to draw those conclusions. But in the sense that he was being suffocated by fame. Are you catching on to a pattern here with the Seattle sound guilt? Because I think that I am. Rock stars are supposed to be gods among us. We are supposed to worship them. They get up on stage and we cry or scream or flash them, or maybe all three. But as we've discussed in the previous half of the episode, Kurt never wanted that. He just kept putting out music because he had to, not because he was inspired. He was serving us when, in the traditional sense of the rock star fan base relationship, we're supposed to serve him. Anyways, that's just my take on it, but the song itself is phenomenal. The guitar solo is, whoa, big shocker, great. And I think it was a fantastic way to open up the album. Scentless Apprentice is one of those songs you have to listen to a few times before you can, like, fully enjoy it. It certainly nods to heavier grunge, similar to that of Bleach or Incesticide, and I would recommend it to those who enjoy that sound above all else. I would even argue it takes the early grunge sound a little into the heavier direction, with a great deal of feedback throughout the song. Lyrically, it's one of the group's most interesting songs as well, as it was based off of a 1985 novel called Perfume, The Story of a Murderer by Patrick Süskind. I don't know how to say that. So if you're a fan of horror, I would definitely suggest giving that a read. My sister told me all about it, and it sounds quite interesting. Now the one you're all waiting for, Heart-Shaped Box, is undoubtedly the star of the album, and it's understandable. I don't want to get too far into an analysis, as I frankly think it's been done to death and have nothing genuine to really contribute to that conversation. I will say, however, because I love my interesting facts, for those who don't know, the name of the song was inspired by a collection of heart-shaped candy boxes that Courtney Love had, so I guess you can infer what you will from that little tidbit. The song itself follows typical Nirvana hit formula with slow, moody talking verses and screaming choruses, and of course, a killer guitar solo. If somehow you've been living under a rock and never heard this one before, it's definitely a safe choice for a guaranteed download on Spotify. It is 100% in my top 10 Nirvana songs of all time. If you want the essence of what this band was, well, this is it. Rate Me, the album's fourth track, was met with much controversy, especially with MTV, who refused to let the band perform it live. Similar to Serve the Servants, it is lyrically like nothing I've heard before, and again, interestingly, ties back to the exploitation of Kurt and his family. The media, at the time, was obsessed over Kurt and Courtney, and of course their daughter, Frances Bean. Rate Me, at least from my interpretation of it, again, please take all of this with a grain of salt, gives us a bit of an inside look at how that affected Kurt's privacy, and thus his mental state. If you haven't already, give it a go, and really pay attention to the lyrics and the repetitive riff of the guitar. Then, I want you to go back and have a listen to the riff on Smells Like Teen Spirit. Whether intentional or not, I find the two are quite similar. An interesting callback to the band's first major hit, made even more intriguing by the lyrical content of Rate Me, which directly relates to the impact that first hit has had on Kurt's life. Maybe I'm reading too much into things, but I'm curious to hear your thoughts on it. Now, I don't want to touch on every single song on this album because that would take me way too long, but I need to take a second here to praise track number 5, Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle. It's a mouthful. I think it is horrifically underrated simply for the line, "I miss the comfort in being sad." If that isn't the most band tee and eyeliner wearing, poster covered bedroom, no one understands me, teen angst lyric ever written, I don't know what is, and for that reason, I love the song. If a slow Nirvana song is what you seek, Dumb is the ultimate. Understandably unusual for the group, the song is a surprising hit from the album. The light sound and use of strings in the song is a refreshing surprise 6 tracks into the record. One of their best of all time, in my opinion. I'm sure you've heard it, but if you haven't, I'm not sure why you'd be listening to this show. You might be in the wrong place. Harsher tracks on the album, radio-friendly Unit Shifter, Tourette's, Milk It, and Very Ape, are all almost, I would say, updosed versions of previous releases of heavy grunge kind of songs. It's as if they heard the criticism from Nevermind being too poppy and in true punk fashion, wanted to give a big few to those who question their roots. Of these songs, my favorite is definitely Very Ape, but if intensity is what you seek, I'd go with radio-friendly Unit Shifter first and foremost. And last, but absolutely not least, is All Apologies. In my humble opinion, this is the best song Nirvana ever wrote. It has everything you could ever want from the group. It highlights Kurt's iconic voice, which is mellow in the verse and again screams in the chorus, but it differs from the formula of many of their other hits, as the screaming element is not without control. When Kurt finally lets go in the last lines, you can really feel the emotion behind it. Similar to Dumb, the use of instruments beyond the trio's typical guitar-based drum mix adds depth and a wee bit of elegance that just works. It's a phenomenal piece of music and excellent representation of Kurt Cobain at his very best. Now it is time. Let's get into the ranking. Coming in at number 12, we have Tourette's. 11 is Milk It. 10, Radio-Friendly Unit Shifter. 9, Scentless Apprentice. 8, Very Ape. 7, Rate Me. 6, Pennyroyal Tea. 5, Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle. 4, Dumb. 3, Heart-Shaped Box. 2, All Apologies, and number 1, Serve the Servants. In terms of must listens for this album, I mean it's all of them. I've said that the past 2 times probably, but All Apologies is an absolute must. If it's just going to be one, it's got to be All Apologies. And a song that you should expose yourself to if you haven't already, since All Apologies is a pretty big hit, I would say Serve the Servants and or Frances Farmer is your best bet. Now, just when you thought I was done, I'm not. On the official initial release of the album, That's the complete track list, but there is one hidden gem that I want to turn you on to if you haven't already heard it. Throughout the band's career, none of drummer Dave Grohl's songs actually managed to make it onto a record. Obviously, he has some writing chops, as evident in his now however many albums with the Foo Fighters, but how are Nirvana fans to know that? Well, there was a B-side to In Utero that was released on the anniversary edition that was actually written and on the demo version sang by Mr. Dave Grohl. It's called Marigold, and you can find it on Spotify. I highly recommend it. It's actually one of my favorites. As for live albums, I wanted to give a special mention to the band's now iconic 1994 MTV Unplugged in New York performance. This session was, in fact, unplugged, making for a stripped-down setlist filled with covers and some of the group's lesser-known songs. Probably the most well-known cover on the album is their version of The Man Who Sold the World, a Bowie song that never really went all that big. I mean, at least for Bowie standards. It's probably the best recording from the session and another cult Nirvana essential. Another cover, Where Did You Sleep Last Night by Lead Belly originally, closes off the record and is an excellent representation of the way Kurt really threw himself into the music. His growling cry by the end of it makes it easier to understand how performing might have impacted his stomach problems. He really sang from the pit of his gut. My personal favorite from Unplugged, though, has to be their live rendition of All Apologies. I'm a strong believer in that if a band is even better live than they are on their records, they are truly a great talent. Now, when you have one of the best bands of the 90s playing one of their best songs live in their prime, I mean, what's not to like? I'm not going to be ranking this one because it's simply too difficult, but I will have this bit of an opinion to share with you. If you're going to listen to one Nirvana album all the way through, please make it this one. If Nirvana was one thing, it was a band made up of true music fans. Each song on this album carried meaning, from their influences in the covers to their prouder earlier work as seen in About a Girl and in Utero songs, which demonstrated their progression to where they were at the time. And there's just something about Kurt's voice in these recordings. I don't know. It's the best I've ever heard it. That being said, that concludes our first episode of The Downbeat. So thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. This was my first attempt at this little show that I'm doing all on my lonesome. So give me some time, give me some ideas if you want to reach out to me. My Instagram is megan.folsom. There's no H in it and no excessive A's. megan.fulsom. Send me a DM if you want to fight about my opinions or provide me with any content ideas. So thanks again for listening to Radio Laurier. I'm Megan, and this was The Downbeat.